Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 6th of April 2022 and you're listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index with David Taylor. That's me and Phil Bishop.
That's me.
Morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
Now, I've heard a rumour that you've signed the pledge. Does that mean that you're on the wagon or have I got my wires crossed here?
You've completely got your wires crossed. I've not signed any pledge because I haven't been building any high-rise buildings in the past 30 years.
I'm very glad to hear it. You better explain, Phil.
The pledge, what this is all about, we've talked about it before, how when Michael Gove became the Secretary of State for what is now the Department of Levelling Up, he was in quite bottom backside kicking mode with the developers on the whole post-Grenfell cladding and fire safety remediation. Ever since it's nearly 5 years ago now, the fire and lessons that came from it, it's been terribly slow progress getting all these things sorted out. And initially the focus is all on buildings over 18 metres, and he came in and said, well, look, I want to get the industry to pay for, developers to pay for putting right buildings between 11 metres and 18 metres. And I want them to go back 30 years. And he made this big threat, basically, in January to the housing developers, saying, if you don't sort it out, we're going to bring in legislation that will hamper your ability to do business. Unspecified threats, but it was quite clear they had to do something. And they squealed a lot and said, it's not fair. We didn't do anything. We haven't done anything wrong, Gov. Not fair. Anyway, the 5th of April was the deadline, which was Tuesday this week.
That was yesterday.
Yesterday, as we speak. And the first to come out was first thing yesterday morning with Cress Nicholson say, we're signing this pledge. And the pledge is to undertake to fix cladding and other fire safety issues on all buildings over 11 metres in height that they've built since April 1992 in the past 30 years, which considerably widens the scope of their presumed liability. Over the past few years, every time house builders announce their results, the public listed ones, that is, announce their results, they all say, oh, and, you know, these results include 10 million, 20 million, 30 million, whatever the number is, provisions for fixing cladding.
Yeah.
But that was before they realised, or before it was imposed upon them, how wide this liability was going to become. So Cress Nicholson, for example, are now saying they still don't know quite what it's going to cost, but they're saying it's going to be between 80 million to 120 million. Then later that day, yesterday, Taylor Wimper came out and said, this is now going to cost us 245 million, but we're signing the pledge. Barclay signed the pledge, but no mention of what the cost would be for them. And Persimmon signed the pledge, and they said, we still think it's going to be 75 million for us. No change there. And then on this morning, Wednesday morning, two more of the publicly listed developers have come out and said, yep, we've signed the pledge. Redrow and Gleeson, MJ Gleeson. Redrow's, their existing provision for fire safety in high-rise buildings had been 36 million, quite a lot.
Yeah.
But now they're saying it's going to be 200 million, an additional 164 million. And even that's still not fixed. They're saying it's a highly complex matter, and the exact remediation work required and for the exact number of buildings will still take time to determine.
Yeah.
What I particularly liked about Redrow's statement is that they basically said it's all John Prescott's fault anyway, because they never wanted to build high-rise buildings in the first place. It was the Planning Policy Guidance 3, which encouraged high-density living. And so
that's right.
They'd much rather be building nice family homes that nice family people want to buy rather than rabbit hutches. But they were made to build rabbit hutches like everyone else, and that's why they're in this bind.
I'd forgotten about all this high density stuff, but about 20 years ago now, it was all the rage, wasn't it? We had to pack people into smaller spaces in order to make better use of our environment and facilities. And yes, John Prescott was the one behind all this, looking for high density urban developments. But that all just sort of got forgotten, didn't it?
I don't know where. I don't know if we're still on planning policy guidance 3, or whether we've had 4, 5, and 6, or it's outside any. I don't have any expertise on anything, but it's outside what limited knowledge I have. So, this day and age, we seem to accept that gardens and outdoor space is
important,
more than just desirable. Yes.
I can remember John Prescott being described by somebody rather impishly as density's child. This was back in the back in the day before Beyonce went solo. And that's all gone by the board now. So it's all we need wide open spaces instead of densely packed tower blocks. But I mean, one of the things which this has brought home is that how many of the big house builders actually built multi-story buildings, because I never think of them as building tower blocks, to put it bluntly. I always assume that they make these little chocolate box, three-bedroom semis and, four-bedroom detached houses. That's what I think of as being their staple diet, if you like, and not high-rise or multi-occupancy buildings, but they obviously all been at it.
Well, that's because you live in the countryside and you don't live in London, Birmingham or Manchester. If you live in a big city, there's not a lot of space in the middle of big cities for your little chocolate box cottages. No. It is all high-rise stuff.
Fair dues. Redrow is one of the house builders that's very active in my part of the world, actually. But you can see their developments just as a sort of a cluster of red tiled roofs above their hedge line. They're very low profile. It's surprising to think that they've got these massive bills arising as a result of their foray into multi-occupancy housing.
They can afford it, though.
Yeah, I guess they can, yeah. Especially people, yes, of course, all the big ones. Yes, they're not short of a bob or two.
Well, we dived quickly into that subject, and I wanted to have a brief chat about it being April already. And do you know it's Stress Awareness Month this month?
No. Stress Awareness Month.
Apparently.
I'm too busy to wonder about that.
So you're not aware of stress. You're not even aware of the Stress Awareness Month.
Well, we've discussed these months, years and weeks that crop up. So it's
and days, bogus
Women
things.
In Construction yes. Week, which comes around every year. And we're usually fairly dismissive of them because we usually conclude that these are issues that should be given due consideration all year round rather than just being the focus of attention for a short period of time.
Absolutely.
But no, I didn't know about this Stress Awareness Month. I wasn't aware of it. So, I know, maybe their PR isn't what it should be.
I just thought.
What does it mean?
I just thought I'd mention it so we could slag it off.
No, I wouldn't do that. No, I will try to be a little bit more aware of my own stress.
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to denigrate the concept of stress awareness. As we said before, we don't denigrate the importance of any of these issues that these awareness days and months have. But it's just the concept of the days and months of weeks for whatever cause it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there we are. Okay, I'll have to just make sure that I'm a little bit more aware of my stress levels because they probably affect other people in the building as well.
And the start of April always means one thing traditionally, which is April Fool's pranks or jokes or whatever, which you're probably like me, as we get older and older, we become less and less tolerant and find less and less humour in them. But any catch your imagination?
I only saw one, and I can't remember what it was.
Must have been good then.
I mean, it was only 4 days ago, 5 days ago.
Well, I thought I'd seen one. There was a company's house filing on the 1st of April by John Lang to announce that John Lang Construction has filed a change of name to John Lang Delivery. And I thought... You don't get April Fool's company's house filings. It must be real. This is extraordinary.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, it is real. John Lang Construction is now, I mean, the corporate entity, John Lang, is still John Lang, but the main building bit, John Lang Construction, is now called John Lang Delivery. And so I said, well, what's all this about? And said, oh, this is part of a much bigger corporate reorganisation to simplify our reporting structures and so on, and our financial reporting, which I can only assume is tied up with their forthcoming, we don't quite know when it's coming, but we've spoken before that John Lang have been public about the fact that they are moving towards some kind of stock market listing or flotation or public ownership.
Right.
It's Ray O'Rourke and his brother, they're getting on a bit and you know, thinking about the future. So I assume it's all part of this, instead of having lots of strange, where are they all based? Is it Gibraltar or Channel Islands, or they're registered in all sorts of strange places. Cyprus as well, I think, put bits of John Lang. Anyway, this is all part of their housekeeping.
Is that John Lang Construction or is that Lang O'Rourke? Because, I mean, I thought that John Lang Construction ceased to exist when
Ray
O'Rourke bought the company for £1
You're quite right. I've been talking gibberish. Lang O'Rourke Construction has changed its name to Lang O'Rourke Delivery.
Okay. Right. That's more like it.
I can't even. I'm still 30 years behind. I haven't got O'Rourke in the picture here. It's not John Lang. You're quite right, David.
Well, never mind. You won't be the only one being confused by that. This is still a John Lang in existence. It's quite separate.
That's a different thing. It's an investment company.
Yes, that's right.
Is completely different. And I think, but no, Lang O'Rourke Construction has changed its name to Lang O'Rourke Delivery.
Lang O'Rourke Delivery.
That is what I meant to say.
It seems like a retrograde move to me because, as you know, I think that you should
say what you do.
Yeah, say what you do. I mean, you know, it's are they up against Delivery and Uber, Deliveroo and Uber now? I mean, is that what their competition is?
Lang O'Rourke are at the forefront of modern methods of construction, and they build off-site. So they don't do construction.
All they do is deliver.
They deliver buildings on the back of a lorry. So this is all I can think of. Also, as we've talked about, maybe we haven't talked about in the past, but it's the city, historically, tends to be turned off by the idea of construction. And many years ago, there used to be a sort of a construction and building materials, I think it's still there, indexed within the FTSE and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they all started saying, oh, no, we're not a construction company, we're facilities management now. Could you put us in support
That's
services?
Right.
And there was a migration from the construction list to support services or conglomerates or diversified industrials, and no one wanted to be in construction because it was seen to be old and dirty and backward. So I don't know if it's still a touch of that going on.
Of course, one of the prime examples of that trend was the creation of Interserve, which we've also mentioned many times before, and indeed Carillion, both very high-profile construction firms that diversified into services and tried to sort of, not quite moving out of construction, which a lot of companies did, but try and distance themselves a little bit. And of course, we know how that ended up. But of course, Interserve has now gone in the opposite direction, sold off all its services side of the business and focusing on construction again. They've even gone back and called themselves Tilbury Douglas, which both you and I agree was a wise move. So they seem to signal a reversal of this trend, and that's probably, I imagine, because of the problems associated with the previous policy of
Interserve, the soiled brand.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're not publicly listed anyway anymore, so it doesn't matter. They're privately owned by banks, and Tilbury Douglas is
who? Tilbury Douglas.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought the and apologies for my confusion of John Lang and Lang O'Rourke. It is, of course, Lang O'Rourke, but I thought the Lang O'Rourke Construction changing its name to Lang O'Rourke Delivery, it may or may not be significant, but interesting and unnecessary.
Unnecessary, yeah. Yes, I'm sure they have their reasons, but I don't know what they might be. Talking about boardroom activities, there was a snippet of news that came in towards the end of last week, which I didn't really take much notice of, but it seems to have set you off on a quest to explore corporate governance in the contracting sector. And you've been digging around in people's executive teams, haven't you, to find out who does what?
Yeah, I'm not sure corporate governance is the right expression, as much as management. I mean, corporate is like the sort of PLC boards. Anyway, what struck me as a really interesting move was last week, Kier announced that their human resources director, a woman called Helen Redfern, has been given a new job title, Chief People Officer. And I thought, oh, obviously they couldn't afford to give her a pay rise, so they're given a new job title. And I read a bit further, and there's more to it than that. I mean, Chief People Officer is normally just another name for Human Resources Director or Personnel Manager.
Yeah, yes, of course.
You know, these things change with time, and Chief People Officer so has become a voguish phrase. But it's more than just a new job title. She's not just still got all the HR director function for Kier, which has got 11,000 employees. So that is a big job. If you're HR director of an organisation with 11,000 employees, that is a huge job. I mean, I'm sure she's got a whole team beside her. It's not her on her own doing it all. But that's, in most companies, that's a boardroom, or if not corporate boardroom, a sort of an executive leadership team role.
Yeah.
But she's not just doing the HR stuff. As Chief People Officer, she's also in charge of the whole sustainability agenda, social value, environmental, social and governance, along with all the staffing issues traditionally associated with HR. Now, that is a whole chunk of stuff that she's in charge of.
Yeah, and a half.
And I had...
That's a lot for one person.
Various things that crossed my mind. I don't know the people who run Kier particularly well at all. I don't know this woman at all. I'd never heard of her until reading this announcement. But it makes me think all sorts of various contradictory things. One is that she must be absolutely amazing to be given such responsibility. Or contradictorily, it made me think, blimey, Kier don't think these jobs are very important if they're bundling them all up together into one person.
That's the other side of the coin.
Because I didn't mention, also involved in that, I think, is safety, health, environment, quality, so the SHEQ things, I think, are also included in that. Now, this is what made me look to what other Kier's competitors do with not their PLC boards, where it might be just the chief exec, the finance director, and half a dozen non-execs or something who meet once a month. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people in day-to-day charge of running the business who are employees of the business. Who sits at the top table? You know, who's in the chief executives? Yeah. You know, who are the prefects? And there's interesting differences between how they do it. Some teams are really quite small, and some are really quite large, and all sorts of different types of people. And it's interesting the types of people who, for example, have the sustainability. Some people have a sustainability director on the top team, and they can come from all sorts of different backgrounds. I would expect someone who has that sustainability role, which I think of as being environmental, but sustainability is more than just environmental. It is also people. Yeah. There are other aspects of it, but I still think of it as an environmental thing. And therefore, I would expect it to be someone who is either an environmentalist or an engineer or a scientist or someone who's got that brief. But I've got lots of notes in front of me of all the different companies. But one of the big companies has got an accountant doing this job.
Has got a what?
An accountant who's... is this...
An accountant?
Galliford Try, Phil Tompkins, was promoted in September 2021, Director of Risk and Sustainability to lead environmental, social and governance. Mm-hmm. And he's an accountant. But, however, he is not on the top table at Galliford Try. Galliford Try has got... 6 people on their top table: chief exec, finance director, general counsel, HR, and 2 MDs, MD of building and MD of specialist services.
Okay.
So that's quite... Actually, what's really interesting about Galliford Try is their general counsel is not a lawyer, but a chartered engineer, MICE and MI-struck-D, Kevin Corbett.
Oh, right. Which is, okay.
That's unusual. And so it got me going down all these little rabbit holes of the quirks of who sits up, you know, fills which hole in different companies. So the fact that the company secretary general counsel at Galliford Try is an engineer, I thought, was interesting.
Yeah.
Balfour Beatty Executive Committee, if we run through it, it's quite large. 12 people.
Right.
There are CEO, CFO, the US guy, person who runs UK construction. On the executive committee, they've got the guy who runs the HS2 joint venture, Balfour Beatty Vinci.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
That's right.
Then they've got a chief technology officer, corporate affairs director, HR director, investments, rail and utilities, major projects and highways, and general counsel and company secretary. Now, that all seems to me, you know, fairly standard. Logical, I can see that. But interesting that there's no one with environment or sustainability or ESG at that top table. Maybe
is that something that they all have a responsibility for, do you think? Or do you think it's sort of just rolled in with other stuff?
Possibly. I mean, I would have thought that, I mean, social value particularly, I would have thought it might come under corporate affairs, and maybe ESG comes under corporate affairs. But in environment and sustainability, I would have thought in this day and age, a director of eco, of net zero, or and all of those things would be a prime person. It would be, you know, right at the top. But not
is
not,
there anybody who singles that out for a, you know, for a major role?
Well, Morgan Sindall is interesting.
Okay,
not specifically green, but they do have a director of a director of social value and sustainability on their team. But their top table is huge. They've got loads of prefects. They've got six regional MDs.
Okay.
Then they've got the managing director. This is Morgan Sindall Construction, I should say, not Morgan Sindall PLC. Morgan Sindall Construction. Okay. Six regional MDs. They've got MD, finance, HR. Well, actually, this is another interesting quirk. Morgan Sindall have got a guy called Simon Arnott, who is Director of Procurement and Employee Relations. So he does HR, and he's also in charge of communications, learning and development, and procurement. Now, learning and development being part of HR is sort of normal, except also on that same team, not only have they got Simon Arnott, Director of Procurement and Employee Relationships, which includes HR and L&D, they've also got a head of HR and a head of L&D, L&D Learning and Development.
Yes.
And then they've got a Director of Social Value and Sustainability. And then a few things that seem to overlap, but obviously in their eyes don't, a Commercial Director, an Integrated Strategic Director, a Business Improvement Director, a Cost Planning Director, and a Design Management and BIM Director. So you've got those five directors who also all sit on there. Okay, maybe the difference is that we're talking
That's
about...
That's an interesting... Yeah,
maybe
interesting
the difference is that we're talking about Morgan Sindall Construction, and there's a higher corporate entity above that. And maybe if we looked at Kier Construction rather than Kier PLC, we would find a much broader range of names on there. Contrast that with BAM Construct, for example. BAM Construct's got four people on its executive board.
Just the four?
Chief exec, executive director, HR and finance.
Nice and simple.
But then I'm only going by what's on their website, so maybe they never meet as a foursome, because it says below that, it says they're assisted by a team of people, including, and list, seven regional directors, and then you've got marketing and comms, new business, and the four different subsidiaries, BAM Design, BAM Properties, BAM Site Solutions, BAM Facilities Management,
right.
Four MDs. So you've got four MDs, seven regional MDs, plus new business, corporate development, basically, and marketing and comms. But again, no one there in any of the, you know, either by the four at the top or the more than a dozen next level down. There's no one with a sort of green or sustainability or social value or any of these sort of buzzy things in that team, which you know, when BAM are very hot on these things, so maybe it's all, maybe, you know, the chief exec James Wimpenny, maybe that's part of his beat, and maybe that, you know, same with some of the other companies where they don't specifically say our director of saving the planet is so-and-so, that it's either everyone's or it's the chief exec's job. I don't know.
Well, it is interesting to see how differently different tier one contractors decide to organise their sort of senior management teams, because they are, look, you sent me a list very helpfully, and looking through them, obviously the ones which you've mentioned and others as well, they are all very different, and it just a quick glance seems to sort of suggest a completely different approach, a different sort of corporate character or culture because of the way they've done this. As you say, bam, with just four at the top, presumably being a tight-knit team who can sort of sit at the top and oversee everything else, and then a large team below them. And then there are the more sort of, I don't know, more horizontal
collegiate structures
where the... Yes, where it's where the responsibility is spread out over a wider but sort of less vertical structure. It's fascinating. There's one that you mentioned, which I think is worth noting, and that's Holly Price at Keltbray, because she's...
also in the news. Promoted last week.
Also in the news. Well, yeah, you tell us about Holly Price, because I think she's an interesting character.
Well... Purely from what I've read, I mean, I first heard of her when she was the president of the Demolition Contractors Federation, 2019-2021, two-year term. And she comes from a very much an ops engineering technical background. She trained as an engineer, became apparently Europe's only female explosives engineer in the demolition industry. I don't know if that's still the case, but certainly for a period. And so she came up that route and then became... at Keltbray, their training and development director. So it was in what, sorry to stereotype, we're doing it, what was traditionally seen as a man's world, you know, the only woman explosives engineer, moving into training and development, which is a much, you know, less male world. Anyway, she became skills and communities director, and she's now been made group sustainability director, which is a big job, particularly these days, everyone going for net zero and everything more than that, that sustainability is involved in sustainability, including economic sustainability, which people tend to forget. And this includes net zero, social value, diversity and inclusion, health and safety, welfare, well-being, whatever it is. She's got all of that. Now, she's as far as I can see, she's one of the few people with that brief to come from an engineering background. It's kind of good that, on paper, I mean, it makes sense to me, put it that way, that to bring together someone who's got the training and development experience with a proper, hard, roughy-tufty engineering techie background, to be in charge of all of those things, makes her kind of a rare and valued commodity. But she's not been given a seat on the Keltbay Executive Board. The only woman on Keltbay Executive Board is their people director, the HR manager. Other than that, it's all the blokes. It's chief exec, chief operating, finance, commercial, and six MDs of the various different bits, like demolition and energy, rail, infrastructure, and so on. So sustainability director, I mean, hey, maybe in a, you know, you have to serve your time and then as a director, and then you get put on the executive team. I don't know. But just on paper alone, it struck me as, I thought, well, if you're in charge of, what are you, group sustainability director in charge of net zero, social value, diversity and inclusion, and health and safety, I would have thought that would be important enough to be on the top table.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, it is, I think most other firms consider it to be absolutely central. I mean, it does affect everything else, really, doesn't it? That's such a broad brief anyway, that you'd expect her to have an overview and be able to sit on the executive board. But I guess they have their reasons, as you say.
A lot of it's to do with fashion, and frankly, if I'm cynical, it's to do with, you know, virtue signaling. It's like saying, not that the work that these people do isn't important, but the titles they are given. There was a time when the health and safety director of a construction company was a very senior, important person, and that was their job. And then things get bundled in. It's, we've now got to give that some importance, like welfare and other things. And then, quality. And so it becomes SHEQ. And,
yes.
And things get bundled in. And this is why we're seeing these sort of new roles emerge. And for Keir to put all of that into Helen Redfern's portfolio, I can't help thinking, these things are too important to all be piled on one person, however brilliant she may be.
Well, as you say, maybe she's Superwoman, and the best person to tackle all these jobs. But
more likely, and let's not personalise. I don't mean about her, but my experience of companies I've worked for, you have a whole team of people who know what they're doing, and sitting above them is someone who's a very capable corporate politician, but doesn't really know anything about the work that I've been doing. It's just a reporting channel.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it.
Helen Redfern, from an HR background, will be relying on the brilliant people she's got working for her, who are health and safety professionals, who are environmentalists, who are scientists, who are engineers, who have got the expertise, and she is simply the filter, the funnel through which all these people reach the top of the company.
At which point, I, for some reason, the name Joe Biden sprang into my mind.
Go on.
How much does he actually know about what's going on? I mean, he's the boss man, you know, the leader of the free world, all the rest of it. But
he got the gig on the basis of his foreign policy expertise. He's meant to be Mr. Foreign Policy.
Yeah. But I think somebody in a position like that, you know, I bet there's whole areas of his of responsibility below him about which he knows nothing at all. And that's probably true of, well, I'm sure it's true of Boris Johnson. But anybody in a senior position like that, it's not necessarily an in-depth encyclopedic knowledge of your remit, I suppose, or the remit of your department that matters. It's more the ability to manage those who are actually steering
who
the ship.
Who have the knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. The leadership skills are perhaps more important than the knowledge or experience that you might possess.
Yeah. I've never been in that position, so I wouldn't know, Phil.
But you talk about Biden. I think we can look much closer to home. I mean, Boris Johnson has gone flip-flop from... wind energy is absolutely useless, to suddenly wind energy is essential. Let's put, you know, go back to onshore wind power. To suddenly everyone getting, Tory MPs and Tory voters going, no, we don't want it. I mean, Grant Shapps are saying, yeah, great idea, but you know, no one wants it. And can't do it.
And somehow you've got to try and convince people at the same time that fracking's not so bad after all. So you've got a lot of conflicts to resolve there.
Yes, yes. That's coming up, apparently. There's an energy paper or strategy coming out imminently.
Mm. Well, that'll be interesting.
Probably something to talk about next week.
Yeah, definitely. Where are we going to go now, Phil?
Should we go upstairs?
Let's go upstairs. Yes, that's a good idea. Careful how you tread.
Hang on. Whoa. Careful how we phrase it, David. Not together.
No. Go on, you better explain.
Well, I had no idea that, purely because it's something I had never thought about, but there is a British standard, BS5395-1, on stair designs.
Right.
And it specifies various things, slippiness and banisters, and particularly the depth of I want to use the word tread, footfall. I don't know how to describe it. Tread is like what's on the bottom of your shoe, isn't it? But the distance between when you put your foot on the stairs, when you're going up your stairs, from heel to toe, if you can get your heel to toe on the stair, that's what we're going to call depth for the purposes of this conversation.
Well, it has actually got a proper term. That's called the going. Yeah, the rising is the vertical difference between steps.
That makes sense.
The rising, okay. But the distance between the nose of the stair and the back where it meets the next one going up is called the going.
Oh, okay.
So the rising and the going.
So anyway, British standard says the going. I'm still going to call it the depth, but the going should be 250 mm, 25 centimeters. Mm-hmm. But British standard is not enshrined in law. And the ROSPA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents, have been campaigning for yonks to make it the law, because there's some amazing stats here. Falls on stairs claim the lives of more than 700 people every year. I'm looking at their Safer Stairs website.
In the UK, is this? I'm assuming.
ROSPA.com. I'm assuming, it doesn't say so, I'm assuming, because it says 700 people every year. This is more than 17 times the number of lives lost on construction sites. 43,000 people are hospitalised every year due to falls on stairs in their home. So improving the safety standard of stairs would significantly reduce the health service bill, the number of people needlessly dying and getting hurt. Now, Rossby had been campaigning for the existing tried and tested British standard, they say, to be made law, to be that, you know, house building, housing developers have to consider dimension of stairs, slip resistance, provision of handrails. They reckon, Rossby, that if British standard BS5395-1 was law, it would reduce the risk of falls by a staggering 60%.
That is amazing.
So you'd only have 300 people dying every year, say 400 lives a year, basically. Anyway, the reason why this is in the news is they announced Rossby. I've seen nothing from government on this, but the government have told Rossby that they are consulting on updating the building regulations to include it as mandatory.
Right.
You also have to have two handrails, which is interesting. I've only got one handrail in my house. We have to have two handrails, one of which must always be within reach.
If your staircase is against a wall, you need a handrail on that side as well. Is that what they're saying?
That's what it says, I think.
Okay, yes. I suppose, yeah.
Which, at the moment, I don't feel that I do, but I can imagine, you know, give it 10 years, I might be starting to think about it.
So they want. So what are the exact changes that Rossby wants to see? They want to see the going increased by 25 millimetres from 225 to 250. Is that right?
I think the minimum at the moment is 225 is the current minimum.
Okay.
But the standard, if the standard became law, it would have to be 250. The going would have to be at least 250. So that's 25 mil, 2.5 centimetres, which doesn't sound much, but I suppose it's the difference between your foot being safely on it or not being on it.
I wonder if that's because people's feet are getting bigger. What do you reckon?
Well, that's got to be part of it. People are getting...
Yeah.
Oh, young people today. Problem is, though, I said that liars, damn liars are statistics. I was saying if 700 people are dying a year from falling downstairs and the risk of falling can be reduced by 60%, we're going to have 60% fewer deaths. That's, of course, not the case. Because we're not going to be retrofitting staircases into Granny's cottage where she's got these little stairs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's only going to be new build houses.
Yeah.
So it's going to have absolutely marginal effect for years and years and years to come.
Yeah.
But at least it will be improving the situation. But most houses are already built. I mean,
yes, of course.
Obviously. I mean, most houses in 10 years' time have already been built now.
Yeah.
Maybe you can get an overlay for your... No, that wouldn't work, would it? I think of an overlay for your stairs that you could... like veneers on teeth.
I don't think that would
work. You
could
make them wider without changing the geometry of the stairs, so that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
I won't go on to that. I won't take that one onto Dragon's Den.
Well, I have to say, when you first alerted me to this... this story, I grabbed a tape measure and went to measure my back stairs, and the reason I did that was because very often
I know you live in a big house. Your back stairs, you have two sets of stairs.
Yeah, because I live in a three-story house on the steep hillside, and we've got one set of stairs that goes from the middle floor up to the top floor, and another one which goes from the middle floor down to the bottom floor.
Down to the servants' quarters.
Yes, which is where I am now. Yes, exactly. So those are my back stairs, okay? We actually had those put in about 9 years ago, and I didn't think there was enough space to put in a staircase, and our builder said, no, we can do that. And the thing is, I very often trip going up them. I don't lift my foot high enough. I don't know why. Maybe it's just age. But I thought, maybe they're not compliant. And so I went out and measured them. And in fact, they are. The going is 250 millimetres and the rise, I think, is 200. So, I mean, it's perfectly within the parameters. I'm just dragging my feet, I guess. So Yeah, I mean, if they were any steeper or if the going was any narrower, then I probably would fall over.
If you're catching your feet walking upstairs, that suggests it's because the going, you know, if you're better off with a 225 going, because you're lifting up a foot to go it onto the next step, and the next step isn't quite near enough to you, and you're not reaching it.
It could be.
You're not getting firmly on it, so it's too far away. So walk the dog, where there's some steps, you know, outdoor public footpath steps, whether those damn ones where you never know whether to take a step in between or to stride out and do one step at a time. And you often see sort of, you know, public steps or up outside museums or something. You think, ooh, can I stride one step at a time here, or do I have to take little shuffly steps in between?
Yeah.
But I suppose if it's obvious that it's difficult, awkward, you take more care. It's when you think it's a perfectly normal set of stairs that you get fooled.
Well, I suppose people go up and down stairs all the time. It's a perfectly normal thing to do. And you never really give a second thought to how those stairs were designed. But clearly, the ergonomics of a staircase are extremely important, because, you know, if each step is too high, then that makes it harder going up and perhaps more hazardous coming down. If the going is too narrow, then maybe there's a chance of slipping off and not getting your whole foot on the step and getting a stable foothold. And then there's the handrail. You know, you have one handrail or two. Is it the right height? All these things, we sort of blithely walk up and down these
stairs.
Yeah, we take it for granted. But So did you say that the building regulations aren't enshrined in law, so that you can make a steeper staircase than the one that we normally have?
No, it's the, I'm not sure about this actually. The British standard is not enshrined.
I was going to say, because the building,
I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
I may have. If I've said that the building regs are not introduced in law.
No, I think I probably misheard you. But
I may have misreported it.
Yeah.
The point is, it's a standard that's not enshrined in law.
Right.
And may come to be so.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be much opposition from this. RoSPA's been engaged with the Home Builders Federation and the National Home Builders Council, it's National House Builders Council, and they put a quote from one of the managing directors of Barclay Group, big house builder, saying, "We are proud as home builders to back this move. This will not mean any stairs will have to be retrofitted into existing homes, just incorporated in the design of new builds." Mm. So there's no meaningful cost to developers. It's all about design.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know why it doesn't happen already. But anyway, RoSPA's have been campaigning on it, and they've had. It sounds like they are winning the argument, and good luck to them.
Yeah, food for thought there. What else have you been up to this week then, Phil?
I've not been to Germany, as I'd hoped to. I had an invitation to visit Liebherr this week. They have an annual big press jamboree, different bits of their organisation around the world every year. It's an event I've been on at least half a dozen times on and off over the years. Mm-hmm. It's always a very enlightening thing. And they're showing off the big extension to their mobile crane factory in Ehingen, Germany. And because of the whole COVID thing and travelling, it's all a bit awkward, they sort of slimmed it down. It just became a one-day event rather than a big sort of three-day jamboree. And it wasn't worth anyone's time, money or effort to get there for that. So most people, I think the German journalists still went, but most people dialed into online Zoom or Teams or whatever briefing from Liebherr.
Mm.
So that was all interesting. But one of the interesting things that they revealed is that they have decided not to pull out of Russia going against the grain.
Yeah.
Now, this is interesting. Liebherr, I think by common consent, it's certainly something I feel. I think Southampton Football Club fans would feel. I know that any Liebherr employee I've ever met feels is an enlightened, paternalistic, benevolent employer.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a long view. It's not make a quick grab and grab for the cash and get rich quick. It does things in a considered way. And over the past however many days it's been since Russia invaded Ukraine, there's been pressure on Western companies to move Russia, a lot of fast food places came.
Yeah.
And the organisations which haven't left Russia or didn't leave Russia sufficiently quickly got quite a lot of flack. And I'm looking at you, French companies like Decathlon and the French supermarket that's part of the same group.
Mm.
I think they are now pulling out. But some companies were really quite... And my initial reaction was, oh, Yabu, typical French, you know, cashing in and supporting, giving succor to Putin and propping up the evil empire and this, that and the other. And so for Lee Pair to be staying in Russia, my initial reaction was, That can't be right. They gave a very good defence, and I think you mentioned this the other week that there are, you know, two sides to the story.
Yeah, because JCB and Caterpillar had both announced that they were going to cease operations in Russia, hadn't they? And I'm sure that there were others. The fact that Liebherr said that they weren't going to, obviously, you know, seem to be going against the grain, as you say.
By the end of listening to, and I think it's Andreas Bohm, the MD of Liebherr International, who is talking, saying that Liebherr have got two factories in Russia, a big sales and service operation in Moscow with 7 or 8 branches. So they've got something like 2,300 plus employees in Russia. Mm. Says, our commitment to our employees does not stop at our borders. We're totally against this war, but we're keeping working in Russia for the sake of our employees only. They said they haven't actually delivered any new machines into Russia. I mean, there were some that were on the way when the invasion started.
Right.
Their journey carried on. But they haven't shipped from whether it's the factories in France or Germany or Switzerland, Austria or whatever. They've sent no more machines into Russia. That's all on hold. And they're reviewing the situation every day. And there's obviously angst within the organisation about, are they doing the right thing? You know, whatever they do is wrong kind of thing. They see that. But the bottom line is that the Russian people who work for them are part of the family and they can't abandon members of the family. Mm. They say, you know, we differentiate the people from the government. We don't support the government,
yeah.
We do support our people, which has a value.
Well, I guess so.
Has force.
Yes, it does. I mean, they could say, of course, that they wanted all their employees to declare their opposition to the war or something like that, but that would hardly be fair, seeing as they would be victimized by the Putin government and probably be arrested and put in prison for doing something like that. I don't know. I mean, if they're not doing anything out there at the moment, is it just sales and service, the operation out there, or do they manufacture as well?
They've got two factories manufacturing.
Okay.
I don't know what they manufacture, but they're still got the factories open.
I mean, they could just suspend operations and keep people on full pay.
That's what I would do, and Liebherr can afford to do it.
Yeah.
I would do that. I'd send everyone home, say, we're still going to pay you, but you're going home and, you know, tell your friends and neighbours why you're sitting at home is because our Western capitalist employers are lovely people who keep paying us, but they don't want to be seen to be supporting, you know, this invasion of Ukraine. I'm still not sure. That I think I come down the side of, if you're going to have economic sanctions, we know it's going to hurt innocent Russian people.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point. You cannot rely solely on external pressure on a government. There has to be internal pressure too. So it's all very well for whether it's Johnson or Biden, Macron or whoever the German leader is now, you know, saying to Putin, this is terrible. But if the groundswell of opinion in Russia is such that they're against the war, that would put much more pressure
on
Putin.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Have much more impact on him than anything that foreign leaders say, I think.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, the Russian people, in order for Putin to feel the pain, his people have to feel the pain.
They do.
And it's a horrible, horrible thing to say, but I think either you do economic sanctions or you don't.
Yeah.
And in this particular eventuality, they're warranted.
You can look at it two different ways, really, and I suppose a lot depends on how it's spun by the Putin government. Of course, they're very good at manipulating the news media. But, I mean, if you make the people of a country suffer due to sanctions, you just hope to God that they attribute the blame for that to their government and not to you. Because, of course, Putin will be saying, well, you know, it's not us doing this. It's the EU and America who are putting the screws on us. And so it might even redouble the support that he's getting at home. It's a very tricky one.
The reason why the Soviet Union fell, the collapse of the Soviet Union, was basically because they ran out of money.
Yeah.
The war in Afghanistan, the nuclear race, the money that was being spent on the wrong things, the economy was completely broken.
Yeah.
And that was what caused the end of the Soviet Union and, you know, brought along Yeltsin.
Yeah.
And there was no Marshall Plan from the West. It was unlike, you know, what Germany benefited from in the late 40s. We didn't help Russia. We, the Western world, didn't help Russia rebuild adequately. And therefore, Yeltsin was soon replaced by Putin. And everyone harked back to the good old days of the Soviet Union when there were queues for bread and flour and whatever. And Putin rose out of economic hardship. And the economic suffering of the Russian people and the Soviet people has been the cause of change, revolution, effectively, at every stage of the way in Russian history.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's ever affected change, it seems to me.
Yeah.
So if we want to effect change in Russia, we have to impose economic hardship. It sounds an awful thing to say.
Yes, it does. But I wouldn't like to be in the position that the Liebherr management are in at the moment, because, as you say, whatever they do, it's wrong. Somebody's going to blame them for it. But I think probably you've got to look after your own people. It's, you know, family first, really, as you say.
Oh, smuggle them out.
Easier said than done, unfortunately.
Have you had any success finding a Ukrainian family to give refuge to?
We have been in contact with a woman and her 14-year-old son. She's a lawyer. She lived, not in Mariupol, but not far from it. She's now in Germany with her son. Her 18-year-old daughter has stayed behind, as has her husband. And we started to go through the process of trying to apply for visas. It was extremely lengthy and difficult. And in the meantime, she's decided that she's going to stay in Germany. So that came to nothing.
I think that's what the Home Office is hoping will be the general trend.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're probably right. But there we are.
Well, good for you for trying. nothing's happened our end. Although I believe we've been in touch with charities in this country and registered our availability.
Yeah. Well, you never know. Things might happen. But I don't know. The way our government's going about it does seem to be, I don't know, ridiculous. It's sort of this sort of Byzantine process of having to go through charities and private channels. And Facebook seems to be the channel that most people are going through. But anyway, we'll see what happens.
Any other business, David?
None that I can think of, Phil. No, I think we've done it.
Well, it's been a bit of a bumper episode this week, which is only fair and fitting because it's our 100th episode.
Makes me feel old. Remember, when you say 100. We're 100 today. Yeah. Yes, unbelievable.
We've been doing this for just over 2 years and we've done 100 of these. Thank you for all the feedback which I asked for listeners. Mostly, it seems to be you're wanting us to be more useful and helpful in your jobs. You're looking to the wrong place for that, folks. We cannot be useful or helpful. The best that we can do is natter on and ask questions that we don't know the answer to. So you're looking in the wrong place for that. But we will continue to be here for the next few weeks at least.
Yeah.
And hopefully much, much longer. So anyway, happy 100, David.
Yeah, and to you, Phil. Let's go and light a few candles.
And blow them out again.
Yeah.
Yes, right. But until next week, and we will have our 101st episode, from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.